Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Slow food, slow money, sound, well, slow. And in our fast-paced society where time is money and the most profitable food businesses are fast foods, how can slow be good? That's what we're going to explore this hour. Coming up later, we'll talk to the co-founder of Slow Food Columbus, the local chapter of an international movement, and we'll hear about a Wexner Center film series focused on food and environmental issues. Joining us now is Woody Tash. Woody is the chairman of the Slow Money Alliance, and he's the author of Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, Investing as if Food, Farms, and Fertility Mattered. Woody Tash will be the keynote speaker at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association's 33rd annual conference this weekend in Granville. So we'll post a link to the conference on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more about that. But right now, welcome to the show, Woody.
Thanks, Ann.
Question for our listeners. The slow food and the slow money movements are related. They both espouse a new economy that values sustainability and locally produced goods. Have you tried to change your eating habits and investing principles in that direction? Give us a call and tell us your story, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and there's Facebook and Twitter as well. Woody, in the foreword of your book, Carollo Petrini, the founder of the slow food movement, says that the potential of slow money is to reorient capital away from endless cycles of consumption and a relentless focus on markets. And yet, after 9/11, the president of the United States told us to get back to normal, to go out and spend. So we're told that spending money is what makes the world go round.
Well, it's complicated.
Right.
And before we even say anything else in response to the way you're setting that up as an either-or, I would say the task before us all is to get beyond either-or.
Okay.
So, you know, is it liberal, is it conservative, are you for growth, against growth, you know, for capitalism, for socialism, all these things. These are all, I would say, choices of the 20th century that are not really that applicable in the realities of the 21st century. So, you know, is investing some of your money near where you live in things that you understand, is that liberal or conservative? And the answer is, it's both. So, which is my long way of saying, we're not trying to get rid of the economy, the global economy or the fast money economy. We're just trying to rebalance. We're trying to say, if we put all of our eggs in that basket, we're going to end in a bad place.
In the last hour, one of the callers said, we got to stop thinking about 1 or 2 years ahead of time. We have to have a 100-year plan. And I told him, well, you might want to stay tuned and listen to the next hour, because that sort of sounds like what you're talking about. This is very long term.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that again, that let's see, two answers to that. One is, yes, we're dealing with a system that took somewhere between 400 years and 75 years, and I'm referring to the whole modern financial system, starting with the first limited liability corporation in the Netherlands, 1600-whatever, and that's the 400-year cycle. And then the 75-year cycle, which is two or three generations, depending on how you want to count, that's the modern industrial agricultural cycle. So these things are not going to be changed in a couple of years, but... we can never know how fast things can change once you start letting some energy move in a new direction.
It all goes back to the earth, literally the soil. And you say, though, the problems we face with respect to soil fertility and biodiversity, food quality and local economics are not primarily problems of technology, but of finance. And that speed is part of the problem. What's the distinction between the technology and finance in this case?
Well, that's a great question, the way you asked it. I mean, obviously they're linked. I would say, you know, what's broken in the global financial system is really just a mirror of what's broken in the industrial agricultural system. So, you know, everything is kind of connected. We're moving towards, you know, monoculture, towards squeezing, you know, trying to trick risk-return yields, whether we do it in finance through derivatives or in agriculture through GMOs. So you know, it is all tied together. That said, money is something that we can decide to use differently. You know, we can decide we want to take some of our money and do something differently with it. We don't have to ask a technologist for permission. We do have to maybe ask a fiduciary for permission. We have to ask our investment advisor or our portfolio manager to let us take some of our money back to do something different with it. But we can actually use our money in a different way. And again, I have to add before I finish that, not all of it, just some of it, in order to begin moving in a different direction.
You call it industrial finance, which, you know, we think about industrialized agriculture,
yeah.
Industrial finance, and that kind of is kind of maybe what got us where we are right now a few years ago.
Right. That's a perfect segue from the previous question. So if we're sending our money around the planet seeking the so-called highest rate return or the highest risk-adjusted rate of return or the lowest labor costs or all the things that go along with that, we're going to get the kind of food system we currently have, which is food that is, let's say, shelf-stable, that's as cheap as possible to produce, and that's agnostic, if you will, to labor practices, environmental practices, nutrient density, soil fertility. All those things are kind of considered externalities. And that, to me, is industrial finance, and it's tied to industrial agriculture.
My guest is Woody Tash. He's the chairman of the Slow Money Alliance. He's the author of a book about that. It's called The Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, Investing as if Food, Farms, and Fertility Mattered. And as I mentioned earlier, he is going to be speaking at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association's 33rd Annual Conference this weekend. For more information, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Woody, get it in. The number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I thought it was kind of interesting. You mentioned an example. You related in the book when you met the cheesemonger in Bra, Italy. Uh-huh. In 2000, and his family had been selling cheese, you figured it out, in the same place for at least maybe more than 50 years. And when you related that scene to a friend at home, he said, we have a name for that in the U.S. It's called socialism, and you say that slow money is no ism.
Right.
That kind of goes back to your initial statement, I think.
Yeah. I mean, again, we are well-trained in this country by the superficiality of our political discourse and information that goes too fast, so that we don't have time to process it. Mm-hmm. No, just to label something. So you say, oh my God, this is socialism. You're talking about too much about social capital, about relationships, and about families and place and connection to the land. And, you know, capitalism can't work that way. And I just don't believe that at all. This is about a form of capitalism, a form of entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, a farm is an entrepreneurial enterprise. And just because it can't grow to $1 billion, or it can't produce food as cheap as a small organic farm in Iowa can't produce food as a, let's say, 5,000 hectare monocultural farm in Chile, that doesn't mean it's not capitalism. So, I'm intrigued with the way you're starting the interview, because you're starting with all of the big ideas, which is really good. No, which is really good, because the ideas are generational and there is a transformation that's needed in the way we think. But I want to encourage people who are listening to, if they're intrigued, to go on our website, slowmoney.org, and actually look at the 5-minute videos of the 30 entrepreneurs who presented at our last national gathering in October. And you'll see that we're actually talking about real small enterprises. This isn't a theory. But we do need to change the way we think in order to move some of our money to support those enterprises.
Something that really intrigued me and got me on the internet this morning, checking out the Jesse Smith Noise Foundation. I was just intrigued. It's simple, but those are usually the most interesting. You said, in a list of ideas from others that have influenced your own, you included this comment from Edith Muma, then of the Jesse Smith Noise Foundation. She said, does it bother anyone else that we are investing in Monsanto while we are giving grants to sustainable agriculture groups? The idea being, I guess, that they should be investing in sustainable agriculture.
Well, that's a whole other topic.
I know.
And it's a great one. It's a rich one. And it goes like this. Of the roughly $600 billion of professionally managed private foundation assets in this country, 0.1% or so go as grants to sustainable agriculture every year. And that's thing one. That's the grant side. But the issue that's raised in your comment is that the assets, those $600 billion, are invested to, quote, make as much money as possible so we have more to give away, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big paradigm question. And if you think in the 21st century we have enough time to keep doing that, then you just keep doing that. If you think that we need a more integral approach, we have to find ways to invest that are healing the environment while it creates jobs. This would be a restorative economy as opposed to an extractive economy. That's the great challenge of the 21st century. I don't think we have another century to try to create the next few thousand billionaires and hope they give enough money away to clean up the mess.
614-292 is the number to call if you want to speak with my guest, Woody Tash, chairman of the Slow Money Alliance. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi. First-time caller here.
Good.
Woody, I just wanted to say I'm of the next generation, probably. I'm about 25 years old. I'm in law school right now. And I wanted to let you know that I'm 100% in line with exactly what you're saying. And I really think that my generation is savvy enough and smart enough to start doing this kind of thing. I mean, the conversations with my friends use the words that you are using right now. I mean, paradigm, just the way that we're thinking. It's really hard to kind of get through with some of these things, like the binaries of conservative and liberal and all of that. But I think that my generation is starting to think in more terms of gray rather than black and white. I guess I'm just making a comment. I just kind of want to kind of give you a glint of hope. I don't know.
Hey, thank you. It's great. It's great to hear. And I think the challenge, if I can, let's have a little historical intergenerational conversation here. So I'm 60, and the challenge here is to take your impulse and kind of keep it pure and make it so. In my generation, you know, we grew up, let's say, we came of age in the 60s and early 70s, when there was a lot of hope that we were maybe moving in a different direction, or at least we'd seen some cracks in the military-industrial thing, and we were hoping maybe we would move in a different direction, and we didn't figure out how to do it. So, David, there's a huge opportunity here and challenge for people who, let's say you and your friends, to hang on to this and not get swept up into the other, let's say, into the fast world to such an extent that you have to wait until you're 60 to try to do something about it. So that's a very general comment, but I hope you will take to heart what we're talking about and stay true to the course. It's really important. Oh. There's still a tremendous amount of energy, obviously, flowing towards the fast industrial, just grow, go out and spend kind of ideas of the economy. I mean, that is still what is in everyone wakes up and looks at the Dow Jones Industrial Average every day and says that is somehow equating to our national well-being. When you and I, and let's say some of our friends, feel deep down that that is not the case anymore. So we still have a lot of work to do, I guess, is what I'm saying. But right on also.
Right. Just real quickly, I think that my generation is really starting to realize that just this hyper-production, this hyper trying to hit like 8% growth every year is just absolutely not sustainable. It doesn't make any sense. Mm. And it's just going to crash and burn in the end. And we just really need to hold back and maybe try to incorporate some of these methods into the capitalism. I mean, it just makes sense. I'll go ahead and take it off the air.
All right, David, thanks for your call. My guest is Woody Tash. He's the chairman of the Slow Money Alliance and author of Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, Investing as If Food, Farms, and Fertility Mattered. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back and continue our conversation with Woody and also Colleen Yoon. She's the co-founder of Slow Food Columbus. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
When Mitt Romney spoke at CPAC in 2011, he used the word conservatism once. This year?
I know conservatism because I have lived conservatism.
24 mentions for conservative and conservatism. I'm Neil Conan, Ken Rudin, and Dan Baltz on Romney's evolution, plus Paul protests that the main caucuses were stolen. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4. This is 89.7 NPR News, 38 degrees with cloudy skies, warming up to about 43 degrees today. And rain showers tonight, a low of 37. More rain expected for Thursday and a high of 46.
Support for 89.7 comes from St. Joseph Montessori School, presenting Dr. Michael James Dorer, speaking on the 10 most important features in Montessori education, Wednesday evening, February 29th. Reservations at sjms.net.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you. Today on All Sides, we're talking about our food system, the economy, and the environment. Still with us is Woody Tash. He's the author of Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, Investing as if Food Farms and Fertility Mattered. Woody will be keynote speaker at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association's 33rd Annual Conference this weekend in Granville. If you want to learn more about that, go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. Welcome back, Woody.
Thanks, Sam.
Joining us now is Colleen Yoon. She is the co-founder of Slow Food Columbus, the local chapter of a global grassroots organization that links the pleasure of good food with a commitment to community and the environment. Colleen works for Local Matters and runs the Greener Grocer at the North Market in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Colleen.
Well, thanks for having me.
What's slow food?
Slow food is so many things, but I think a good way to describe it briefly is that it's against anything that fast food is and what fast food has done to the way we eat. And it's also good, clean, and fair food. So it's food that's good for us and delicious. It's fairly produced, meaning the people who grow, pick it, prepare it, are fairly treated, and it's good for the environment. So,
and Woody Tash, it's no, it's not a coincidence or an accident, I should say, that Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food, wrote the foreword to your book.
Well, I don't know if it's an accident or not, but it's an honor.
It's not. Yeah,
it is.
I consider Carlo one of the great, world citizens who's doing something really beautiful. And as Colleen said, the idea of slow food cuts across so many different things. It's biological, it's historical, it's cultural. It's really a beautiful thing. And when you see it unfolding around the world or go to some of the big meetings in Europe, you feel something that is, I don't know how Colleen feels about this, but it's a little hard to translate that to the U.S. because, after all, we did invent fast food and export it all over the planet. So we may be the toughest nut to crack when it comes to getting people to really experience the beauty of slow food.
Amen, Woody. Amen.
I'm gonna pose this to Colleen, but Woody, I want you to respond to it too, because it kind of applies in both cases. I think back in 2009, Kim Severson of the New York Times wrote an article and noted Slow Food USA's elitist image. She said Slow Food USA was getting a makeover, and I first wanted to talk about the elitist image. And I was going to ask you earlier, Woody, people listening to this maybe think, well, you got to have money to invest first. What it's in, for people out there who have been struggling, they spent their 401ks down now, what does this mean to them? And maybe Woody will start with you on that score and then talk to Colleen.
Oh, that's such a big issue. Mm-hmm. Probably the simplest way to frame it is to say, again, if you think in generational terms, then you realize we're moving from a place of cheap, buy low, industrial, whatever, to a new to some more balance. And so you can't expect the early adopters, the first people who move in a new direction, to be a perfect manifestation of where we're going. The goal is to get good, clean, and fair food to as many people as possible. Make it as affordable as possible. But when most of the food that's in the market is produced by externalizing all the real costs of production, meaning the long-term cost of the environment, the real impacts on the people who produce the food, when those costs aren't in there, of course you get cheap food. So it's a big generational shift, I think, is the easiest answer. And as, just quickly on the investor side, mm-hmm. I would say, of course, we're talking about investing. We at Slow Money are talking about investing. So there are 60 million or so Americans who have money in the stock market. So many more than that have money in a bank account somewhere. So in a sense, we're all investors, or many, many, many of us are investors. It's really a question of waking up to realize that we have to take some of that money and take responsibility for it directly.
Colleen, what about that? Kim Severson wrote that Slow Food USA was getting a makeover. That was 3 years ago. How's it going?
Well, I'm glad you touched on the elitism, because we certainly get that. And I see why. I mean, a lot of people think that, only the well-heeled can eat well. But Josh Vertel is the new president of Slow Food USA. This past year, we worked on something called the $5 Challenge. And so people all over the country did dinners together with friends and even with people they didn't know. People were invited online in their areas in the community. And we did prove that you can eat well $5 a person. I think Michael Pollan says it well, spend less, spend more, buy less. You know, and eating in moderation, great things in moderation is certainly not a new idea. But yeah, I think we're talking about a couple things. So going from the elitism, you know, we are a volunteer-run organization completely. So, you know, if we do farm dinners and such, it doesn't mean we can't do other things that our membership wants. We just need doers. We need people that want to get involved in Slow Food and Slow Food Columbus, and we invite you to do so. I'd also mention, as far as the investing goes, you know, even if you go to a farmer's market or the Greener Grocer, say, and buy, you know, potatoes from me instead of Kroger, I mean, you're investing. You're investing in the movement. You are, you're helping that entrepreneur, that young farmer. So, you know, maybe you don't have millions to invest, but there are so many farmer's markets in Columbus right now. You can't miss them. They're Saturday. They're, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, so.
No excuses.
Thank you.
But Ann, I also want to just jump in. I'm just thinking of the political year that we're in now. And, you know, when you label someone an elitist, it's exactly the same thing as someone calling Barack Obama, you know, being against American exceptionalism or being a socialist or whatever. It's just a label.
Right.
I mean, should we just say all farmers are rednecks? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's just a stupid label that you're sticking on something. We're trying to solve a very nuanced, difficult problem that has taken hundreds of years for us to kind of recognize. So, you know, stop labeling people and just recognize that we have problems and we're trying to solve them.
Gary in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Woody, you hit on a key word a few seconds ago, balance, and that's a tough one to maintain sometimes. But a number of years ago, I was fortunate to meet a man who was an international business consultant. He was Austrian, been through World War I, World War II. He said the one thing the U.S. economy has to learn, and this was 30 years ago, he said, you've got to learn that along with two steps forward, there's one step back. And I always thought that was an interesting philosophy. And, of course, like I said, he was Austrian, so he'd lived many years. And he was a consultant for companies like Formica and U.S. Steel. So he's a very wise man. I just thought that was interesting.
Well, thanks so much for the comment. And you're right. Balance to me is a very, very important word because, it suggests that we're not either or and we're not trying to come up with some, you know, alternative theory, but we are trying to find balance. And if you kind of translate that into biological terms, that I think would be very helpful if we thought about them economically too, and that's diversity. So when you have a very diverse system, it's more balanced, it's less prone to disruption, it's healthier, it's more resilient. And if you think about monocultural agriculture as the exact opposite of that, where we're driving everything to a few varieties, maximum production, you know, pump it up, we're obviously going to be more prone to disruption and collapse.
Thanks, Woody. Thanks, Ann.
Thanks, Gary. You know, I was listening to a story on NPR yesterday on my way home from work, and it was about how closely we're all connected and how, you know, and how amazing in ways that you never even think about. And they talked about the almond orchards, I guess, I think that's what they call them, in California, how they control basically 2/3 of all the almond market in the world now. It wasn't native to that, but it's transferred very nicely. And how unfortunately dependent they are on bees in the prairie states. And they actually bring the bees and they bring them all the way to California so they can pollinate the flowers on the on the almond trees. And then they take them away and bring them elsewhere. And the problem being that the bees in the plains area aren't getting enough access to pollen anymore because they're planting corn for fuel and things like that. And it made me think about it, an element that came up in your book several times, the idea of natural. What's natural? And to do what's natural, if you do what's natural, then it wouldn't be a problem, but we also wouldn't have access to those healthy almonds either.
Well, you know, I don't know why this is popping into my head, but George Will, on one of the Sunday morning talk shows a couple of weeks ago, I've been meaning to blog about this, made a comment. They were talking about vulture capitalism and Mitt Romney and is private equity bad, and he gave a defense of capitalism talking about creative destruction and all these different things. And he mentioned in his defense of capitalism the miracle of modern agriculture. I'm going to get to your point in a second.
That's okay.
And he said, you know, capitalism is messy. Capitalism sometimes destroys jobs to make money. And he gave the example. He said, look, you know, 100 years ago, half of America were farmers, and now less than 2 million farmers are feeding the world. It's a miracle. So my comment is, yeah, it's a miracle. But do you want to keep betting on miracles, or do you want to start planning for what comes after the miracle? because it's not going to keep, we can't keep going down that road. And so to your point, we have to think about bees. Let's just think about bees and modern industrial agriculture. If you think for a second with common sense, and you think about that we're trucking bees all over the country, feeding them sugar water so they have more energy, blah, 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 so that they can become little factory workers to pollinate our orchards. And suddenly the bee population is collapsing.
Right.
And no one is exactly sure why. My question is, why do we have to know exactly why? The system is imbalanced. It's extreme. We're pushing everything to the limits. Somewhere it's going to start breaking down. So opting towards more natural, more diverse, more disaggregated, smaller units is just a safety. Even if you don't believe in a big new theory, I think it's just a safer way to start thinking to get a little bit more balance.
Colleen, did you want to talk about that, Colleen Yoon?
Sure. It just makes me think about how, when I grew up, I was my family ate seasonally and locally because it's just what you did. You didn't say, oh, I eat locally. I'm doing the right thing. But, honestly, for me, why would you want to eat a strawberry in February? They don't taste like anything. And I struggle with this, managing a for-profit business at the North Market and having fruit from Chile and having it trucked all over the place. So it's a struggle I have every day.
The distancing, because we can, therefore we will. Email from Barbara. I have never understood why many economists talk as if economies must always grow to be healthy. Is it possible for an economy to not grow and still be sustainable and healthy?
Fantastic question. Arguably the most fundamental economic question of the 21st century, and someone named Herman Daly, whoever sent that email should check out Herman Daly, who's an economist. I believe he's still at the University of Maryland. He was at the World Bank for many years. And for the last 30 or 40 years, he's been the one writing from within the economics profession about what he calls steady state economics. He has a book called Steady State Economics, or The Steady State Economy, I think is the name of the book. So it's a huge question. And again, I would say, try to avoid going either or. So how about slow growth? How about, things grow because they have dynamism. So I think the answer is not to be against growth, but it's to be for growth that respects the rhythms of nature and that allows for the health of future generations.
An email from Elizabeth. She writes, I'm a middle school teacher, and one of the saddest themes I have seen in today's society is that people, including my students, rarely seem to be satisfied. The modern interpretation of capitalism is built solely around maximizing profits to the detriment of quality and satisfaction. People should be able to find satisfaction in a job well done or having enough, but even my middle schoolers feel society's pressure to always strive for more, more, more. I think both the slow money and slow food movements are encouraging people to stop and appreciate things, and it can do a world of good.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, I say yes.
Yeah, I say yes, too. I mean, I've been a member of Slow Food since, I think, 98 or 99, before there was a Slow Food USA. It's what struck me is the slowing down part. And if anyone knows me personally out there listening, like, I'm not very slow. I move quickly. I talk quickly. But it's a good reminder, even for me, to slow down and smell the roses, per se. But also the joining people at a table and people from all different walks of life, joining them at the table is just so important, and sharing food with people, so important.
Jerome in Marysville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jerome.
I've got a question. I'm a bit confused about the role between, say, the small independent grocer and the large grocers, the large corporations. It's my understanding that up until recently, the American diet was fairly bland and routine, and that the large companies are responsible for bringing in the diet, bringing in diversity of foods. And I still know people who, live on a very narrow diet, and the idea of trying anything different, sushi is just, beyond their imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a bit struck by the comment about, buying from a small grocer is investing in local and diversity, which is good. But yet Kroger can, through concentration of capital, can afford to bring in imported goods that were not available until recently, which add to the pleasure of food.
Okay.
I mean, getting talk about slow food movement coming from Europe, coming from Italy, well, you know, it would be nice to taste some Italian cheese or some Italian sausage. I also wanted to point out, when you talk to Jews, what is their favorite holiday? It's always Passover, because it takes place in the home. It's a long ritual that takes a while to get through, including the eating, and there's lots and lots of food, and it is extremely slow, and it's every Jew's favorite holiday.
Okay.
So
I'll
take my comments off the air, and thanks.
Thanks.
Colleen, you go first, I think.
Colleen?
Well, I think I'll respond first to... you know, Woody, what you said before, that slow money, you know, you don't want to get rid of the global economy. You just want a better balance. I mean, slow food is all about that. I mean, I'm not going to give up coffee. Are you?
No.
Chocolate, you know, avocado is one of my favorite foods. Slow food celebrates foods that have a sense of place. So, you know, scotch, love it. And then going back to what the caller said, I think I'm a little kind of unclear where he was going with that. But my point was simply that I personally buy from local farmers directly at a shop like the Greener Grocer, supported by Local Matters. And so I have a rapport with the farmer. I know how that stuff is produced. We've been to the farms, we've visited, and so I'm not sure if that really answers his question. But that is why I would suggest supporting those items.
Woody Tesh?
Many issues raised by the comment. By the way, I've never, in 3 years I've been talking about this, I've never heard anyone use the Jewish Seder as a defense of quality food. So that's a beautiful, funny thing. So
go Jerome.
Okay. So a couple of points. First of all, Carlo Petrini actually has a beautiful way of discussing some of the issues that the caller raised, and he used the phrase virtuous globalization, which is, we're not against globalization. We're not against fair trade. We're not against goods going back and forth around the planet. We're against it happening in a way which is destructive to the long-term health of the planet and future generations. So, meaning, we'd love to have lots of small, healthy producers all around the planet, all trading with each other, making their goods available to people all over the planet. So, yes, we want healthy diversity. The problem with the Kroger example is that if the caller were to take the time, this is not a criticism of the caller. I'm saying if we as a society were to take the time to trace the history of all the products that are on the shelves of Kroger, we would find that the vast majority of them are laced with synthetic chemicals, are produced in ways which are exploitive of workers, are contributing to global warming in various ways. There are all kinds of costs of producing that food that do not appear in the cheap prices that that are resulting from the concentration of capital he refers to. So there's a whole lot of hidden costs in there that I would ask him to begin to look at. And the last thing is, here's another example of the hidden costs. The so-called diversity that's on the supermarket shelves is a product diversity. It's packaging, it's labeling, but if you look at behind the scenes, you'll see things like the fact that at the turn of the last century, there were 100 varieties of potatoes in commercial production in the United States. Now, 4 varieties account for something like 95% of potato production in the United States. So we're driving biological diversity out of the system while we are kind of producing, let's say, what appears to be commercial diversity.
Yeah, agreed. You know, again, Michael Pollan says shop on the outside of the supermarket, not in the inside, and that's for many reasons Woody just touched on. Also, you have to understand that large grocery stores have things called loss leaders. You know, they'll even lose money on produce because they make a lot of money on your packaged, you know, macaroni and cheese or whatever it is. And you also want to ask yourself whether the farmer is being fairly paid. And that's a pretty big deal right now.
Well, Woody Tesh, we've run out of time with you. We have to let you go. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. And Colleen, look forward to seeing you soon.
I'll see you at OFA.
Woody Tesh, he's chairman of the Slow Money Alliance. He's author of Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, Investing as if Food Farms and Fertility Mattered. He is the keynote speaker at the 33rd annual... getting there.
OFA Conference.
Thank you. OFA Conference. And if you want to know more about that, go to WOSU.org/AllSides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Nathan Englander has a new collection of short stories based in part on being raised as an Orthodox Jew and having an overprotective mother.
My mother raised me very clearly that if you cross the street, you will die. If you go outside, you will die. If you play sports, you will likely die.
Nathan Englander on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. WOSU Public Media will host Chefs in the City Thursday, May 3rd from 5:30 until 10 p.m. The event is at WOSU at COSI. Celebrity chef Hubert Keller and several of Central Ohio's finest chefs will participate in live cooking demonstrations preparing dishes for audience members to enjoy. The event will also feature a cookbook signing, a silent auction, and will be taped for TV. A limited number of tickets are on sale now. Visit WOSU.org/chefs for more information and tickets.
Support for WOSU comes from the Midland Theater, presenting Dogs Gone Wild with ventriloquist Todd Oliver and his talking dogs, part of Midland Theater's family series, Saturday, February 18th at 7 p.m. Tickets at MidlandTheater.org.
38 degrees with cloudy skies. The clouds continue today, a high of 43 this afternoon. Rain showers tonight, a low of 37. Rain for Thursday, a high of 46. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about our food system, the economy, and the environment. Still with us is Colleen Yoon. She's the co-founder of Slow Food Columbus, the local chapter of Slow Food USA. And welcome back, Colleen.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Dave Philippi. He is director of film and video with the Wexner Center for the Arts. Dave organized the Wexner's third annual Field and Screen series featuring films about food and the environment. We'll post a link to that series on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Welcome back, Dave.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be here.
So what's coming up you want to talk about?
Well, like you mentioned, we're doing our third annual Field and Screen series this month, and it's a series of films that explore food issues and environmental issues in creative ways. And the series has been going the entire month, so we only have three programs left in the series. Mm-hmm. And the next one is this Friday. We're doing a double feature of two documentaries. The first one is a shorter film called Truck Farm, and it's made by a filmmaker named Ian Cheney, who will be there that night. And it's about some people in Manhattan that wanted to bring agriculture into the city in, admittedly a modest way, but they essentially turned the back of a pickup truck into a little garden and started planting like greens and herbs and things like that. And by the end of their project, they were driving around to restaurants and selling some of their produce at various restaurants, and also, you know, introducing the process to kids and kind of educating them about what it means to actually grow something. And then the second film that night is a documentary called The City Dark, and it's also by Ian Cheney, and it traces the history of light pollution from the time that electricity and then the electric light bulb was introduced, how it has in bigger cities, you know, the sky has just disappeared. And if you live in, you know, obviously New York or any bigger city, you look up into the sky and you don't see stars anymore and things like that. And it's really kind of a examination of what that means and this kind of loss of connection with what for, you know, a lot of people is a beautiful, gorgeous thing to look at, the sky.
Both sort of getting back to the earth kinds of themes, Colleen, or the stars, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what is the question?
No, I'm making that connection between the local and what it means to be local and be local and be there and be in the place where you're at.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think slow food is local. You know, eating locally is certainly one thing that we value, especially the community part. And you know, I'm just going to kind of take that a little bit and say what I love to do is connect the producer with the consumer. So, you know, events that we do for Slow Food in the summer, the farm to fork type dinners, I mean, those are just, they really turn me on because you've got the farmer right at the table and everyone's just chatting and hanging out and drinking together and chatting together. And it's pretty special. So.
The truck farm sounds charming.
It is charming. Charming is a very good word for it. It's they show the whole process of what they had to put in the back of the pickup and you know, working out the drainage and working out the watering and everything. And the farmers involved are just so enthusiastic. You know, you can't help but like the film.
I'll actually be attending that event and seeing those movies. And I'm really intrigued because, you know, since you said that the truck has a lot to do with education for kids, that explains a lot because I thought, how much can this truck produce?
You know?
How can they be making any money in restaurants?
I have a picture of it, and it looks just as cute as can be.
Yeah, I know.
Just as cute as pie. 614-292-8510. 8513. 614-292-8513. I've had a trouble with my phone number lately. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org if you want. I apparently have a couple emails coming in, so I'll get to those as soon as I can. Dan in Clintonville, you've been holding for a long time. I hope this is still the right theme for you.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I love the show, and thank you so much for I have tons of stuff I could bring up. I wanted to just bring up an organization here in Columbus that's been around since the early 90s that has been promoting these kinds of things for all that time. It's Simply Living. And Colleen may be aware that for a time, Local Matters was actually a part of Simply Living when they were going through a transition period.
Oh, yes, of course.
And so there are a lot of good resources out there. And just wanted to mention that, and to tie back, your previous guest mentioned nutrient density, and that made me think of another guest that you've had on the show, and Dr. Joel Furman.
Yeah.
And so the food, so much of the industrial food is just very, very low on nutrients, and that is, I think, a big reason why we're suffering from some diseases and similar type things.
Okay. Dan, thanks for holding. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
If you'd like to give us a call and join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests, Colleen Yoon, she's co-founder of Slow Food Columbus, and also Dave Philippi, he's the director of film and video for the Wexner Center for the Arts. We do have a couple emails now. One from Robin writes, here in Coshocton County, we started a slow food chapter to educate local folks on eating healthier and promoting the local economy by supporting local producers. From our discussions came a movement to start a local co-op that stocks food grown by local growers and producers. Does everyone shop there? No, but they are getting more customers every day, and our dollars stay local. Now our local Chamber of Commerce has now asked that some local foods be used in their annual dinner this year. We were able to provide farmers market coupons this past summer for seniors in our area. Little movements can make a difference.
I think that's a big point. At the Wexner Center, for the last couple of summers, we've had a farmer's market out in front of the Wexner Center, and you know, we're going to do it again this summer. And I think it's just indicative of a couple of things. As an art center, especially a contemporary art center, we're committed to exploring and examining, you know, very topical, relevant issues. And, you know, there are a few things that are as important and relevant as the environment and, you know, all of the food issues that have been discussed today. But also, as the email that you just read, you know, these small little steps add up to something. And whether it's a market in front of the Wexner Center or just individuals slightly adjusting their buying habits, those all add up to things. And, I just think it's incredible over the last 3, 4, 5, 6 years how our food has been revolutionized, and I think obviously there's a lot of work to do and a lot of questions to still be answered. But in a relatively short period of time, there has been a tremendous amount of change and an incredible amount of awareness about the issues that we're talking about today.
Well, and certainly Wayward Seed Farm, who lead mm-hmm. the market at Wexner, those guys are fantastic, great growers and very young entrepreneurs and good mentors in our community. Impressive market.
Dave in London, Ohio, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Don't hang up on me. The last time I called, you accidentally hung up on me.
I'm sorry, Dave. I get twitchy sometimes. Sorry about that.
I have a question for Colleen or whoever. I grew up, in high school working on a farm. That's what we did. And then I worked in natural resources until I retired. Then I worked on a farm again. And I'm not now, basically, because I just didn't like the stewardship. But my question is, why aren't some of these groups, the commodities run the farmers. They're producing to make a living, of course, but it seems like high fructose corn syrup and cattle feed and everything else that we don't really need. We need cattle feed, of course, but high fructose corn syrup, there's millions of bushels of corn being produced just for that commodity. Why aren't we doing something push gently into some other forms of food that they can still make money at? What do we need to do to convince these people that they can make money?
Well, I guess the question is, Colleen, can they make the money that they think? There's making money and then there's making money.
Yeah,
and paying for that $300,000 International Harvester combine or whatever they are.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I certainly don't have all the answers. Groups in the city are first of all, Slow Food is a 501c3. We can't lobby. I think Slow Food USA is doing a lot more in policy right now. Local Matters certainly works on policy. A lot of groups here are working on improving the Farm Bill. I would say get involved in working on the Farm Bill here. I guess, secondly, how do farmers make money? It's really volume. That's the tricky part. It's having a relationship with a buyer that can pay you fairly. It's tough. It's a pretty layered, tough question.
Yeah. From Diane on Facebook, she says, I belong to a local organic CSA.
Community Supported Agriculture.
I knew what it was. I think of it as a subscription, but yeah. CSA. It isn't cheap by any calculations, but this business belongs to my neighbors. And what is good for my neighbors or community, then it's also good for me. I'm glad that they are making a success of it. And the health benefits for me are also enormous. I wondered, how you, Dave Phillippe at the Wexner Center, how you're measuring the success of the, you started the farmers market on Thursdays.
Mm-hmm. Right.
3 years ago now? You're going into your third
season, right? This
will be the
third
year,
right? Yeah.
Yes. How do you measure success with something like that?
Well, I think probably in not necessarily the most traditional ways. For example, this summer there is going to be a hiatus for the market when the students disappear for the summer, that takes a big mm-hmm. chunk of the customer base away. But I think it's not necessarily measured just in numbers. It's like, the Facebook post that you just read. I think it's a gesture. I think we're acknowledging the importance of this issue. I think we're trying to bring the farmers that are growing these different products into the city, onto the campus. You know, to the best of my knowledge, there really isn't another market like that in the direct campus area. So giving people that live in that neighborhood greater access to these foods. And even though it's one day a week, again, I think it's these small gestures and these small acts that are, you know, fairly easy to get off the ground. I think they do add up to something. And I think it's just part of, you know, there are a lot of things that are happening at the Wexner Center now that are starting to very directly address the environment and you know, kind of ancillary issues like food. And our education department has been doing something for years called Art and Environment that educates kids about the really interesting ways that art and the environment can you know, those interesting intersections.
That is a neat course.
Yeah, and it's something that we're thinking about all the time, and you know, because artists are thinking about that. You know, unlike I was at on a artist retreat a couple of years ago, and I was kind of astounded how many artists were working very, very directly with, you know, not just the environment, which has been happening for decades, but food. And there was one fantastic artist who developed this mushroom spore suit that was intended. When she died, she would be buried in this suit, and her, you know, her body would become the fertilizer for this mushroom suit. Obviously, it's a little theoretical, but just, you know, people are thinking about things like that, and you know, that's what we're there for, is to reflect what people are working on.
George and Powell, you're on the air. This is sort of along the line of your question, I think.
Yes,
but directed at Slow Food.
Is this George?
Yep, George.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're
I've got a great passion for slow food. Having grown up in the summers on my grandmother's farm, and it's lasted with me. I'm in my mid-50s now, and what I'm really interested in is, as a 501c3, like the United Way, can't you have a more active partnership and participation with children, like with inner city gardens? If you plant a seed with a child, you will create demand for slow food, and I'm proof of it. So that was my comment, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, George. Colleen, you?
Well, you know, I guess the first thing I'm going to say is I'm going to go back to the fact that we are all volunteers. We do what we can. We're all extremely busy outside of our volunteer hours. And, you know, if membership has passion about this, I would love to hear from you. We actually have a Slow Food in Schools committee, and you can find our website, slowfoodcolumbus.org. And I would like to also mention that Local Matters is so strong in the community as far as reaching children. They do a program called Food Matters. And so that's probably my answer.
Well, we're running out of time. I have to say thank you very much, Colleen Yoon, co-founder of Slow Food Columbus. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dave Filippi, director of film and video for the Wexner Center for the Arts. We'll post a link so people can learn more about the films coming up this weekend. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.